Its back was to me as it crossed the meadows toward the encircling hills. Instinctively, I unclipped the bear spray from my belt. But with the bear upwind from me, and with the wind as strong as it was, the spray would be of little use, other than to add flavor to myself. So I also took the bear banger out of my pocket. Meanwhile, the grizzly must have either heard me or caught my scent. It suddenly turned, rose on its hind legs, towering some 9 feet tall, and seemed to be sniffing the wind, scanning the horizon. It was certainly a big, fully grown grizzly. It didn't look at all famished, as one might expect in the spring, when bears have typically shed weight from their winter slumbers. The grizzly remained standing on its hind legs for what seemed an amazingly long time, until, that is, it spotted me, a lone figure on a long, empty stretch of gravel. Then it dropped to all fours and charged. It came barreling across the meadow straight at me. 300 meters separated us, a matter of perhaps 30 seconds. I began shouting hoarsely at it, waving my trekking poles about, and even jumping in the air, all in an effort to appear as large and menacing as possible, hoping to deter the bear's charge. I wasn't sure it was going to work. I'd had polar bears and black bears come at me before and had always driven them off, but this was my first grizzly charge, and I wasn't entirely sure what to expect. But I knew this. I had only 3 bear bangers, and I couldn't afford to use them all up on the morning of the first day of my journey. So I held off on firing a banger and instead kept waving my trekking poles, shouting at the grizzly as it approached. I also knew this. When a bear charges, never run. At least, that's my philosophy. You can't outrun a grizzly anyway, and north of the tree line as I was, there are no trees to climb. Some people advise playing dead, but that's not a tactic I'd recommend unless the grizzly in question is a mother with cubs, and it's clearly a case of having startled her. At about 200 meters, with me still waving my poles and shouting, the oncoming grizzly suddenly halted its charge, wheeled around, and began running back in the direction it had come. As it ran back toward the hills, it glanced over its broad shoulder in my direction several times. For a long while it remained in sight as I cautiously resumed hiking along the road. The grizzly, it seemed, had lost interest in me. It skirted along the edge of the hills, apparently searching for berries. Eventually, it disappeared from view. This was only the first day of my journey, and I knew I'd have to face more bears before it was over, likely many more. I took heart in the fact that most bears, when left alone, are generally harmless. The majority seek to avoid human contact whenever possible, and the behavior I'd just witnessed, a so-called bluff charge, was a well-known characteristic of these Arctic grizzlies. They are, it seems, wonderful practical jokers who delight in seeing whether they can scare hikers or paddlers with one of their bluffs. As part of my academic research, I'd spent years studying bear attacks, compiling a database involving hundreds of fatal attacks on humans stretching back over several centuries. What emerged were some clear patterns. It was obvious that bears were intelligent creatures that seldom attacked a human blindly. Rather, they seemed to calculate carefully before attacking, weighing their chance of success. When attacks on groups happened, bears would consistently single out the smallest member of the party for attack. In almost all cases, it seemed clear that grizzlies would avoid a fight if they could, since for any wild animal, the mere possibility of an injury is often enough to deter an attack, as any injury is likely to bring fatal consequences if it impedes hunting or food gathering. That's why playing dead with a grizzly makes sense only when the bear is clearly acting defensively, such as a mother bear with cubs or a bear defending a fresh kill, and not when the bear is acting aggressively. In those cases, playing dead, running away, or attempting to hide might simply trigger the bear's predator instinct to see you as easy prey. In one of these scenarios, the best thing to do is to look big, make noise, and not flinch. On my first day, I hiked 41 kilometers along the Dempster. The second day, the winds were bad, knocking me around on the road, and I covered only 39. The third day, I increased the time I spent hiking and upped my distance to 59. The fourth day, my best, I managed 62 kilometers over 13 hours of hiking. The film crew had departed on the second day in order to make their long drive back to Whitehorse. The filming, they reported, had gone well, other than when the drone had crashed into a mountain and was destroyed. Meanwhile, Chuck and Mark had been investigating with a fishing rod some of the streams the Dempster passed over. Chuck reported that they were completely devoid of fish. This I could well believe, for if there were fish in those streams, Chuck would surely find them. As my lonely trek continued, the landscape varied. Mostly it was treeless tundra framed by majestic mountains, with quilt-like patches of snow on their slopes, interspersed with exposed rocks and meadows. However, in places where the road crossed rivers and creeks, black spruces and aspens reappeared, as the trees were able to take root in these sheltered valleys. It was in one of these valleys, in 1932, that the mad trapper had met his violent end after a prolonged firefight with a posse of RCMP officers and hired guns. It'd taken no less than 7 bullets, one of which struck spare ammo stuffed in the trapper's pocket, causing an explosion that blew off part of his thigh, to finally bring him down. May that be a good lesson for us all not to store spare ammo in our pant pockets. The mystery of his true identity and his motives was never satisfactorily solved. A drifter who'd come north some years earlier, he'd given the name Albert Johnson, but that seemed to have been a made-up alias, as others knew him by different names. On his corpse was found a considerable quantity of cash and gold, including gold teeth that weren't his own. That's never a good sign, in my experience. Perhaps he'd been a dentist before taking up fur trapping, a common enough career transition. But there were alarming rumors that in places he'd drifted through, the Nahanni Valley, for instance, unsolved murders and headless corpses had a tendency to show up. That first night, I camped in one of those sheltered patches of black spruce, where there was ample wood for a fire, and perhaps, I like to think, as I lay in my tent and watched through the screen door the flames flicker and the shadows dance, the ghost of Albert Johnson, I soon drifted off to sleep to these cheering thoughts. My trek along the Dempster continued early the next morning. The weather was colder, and rain fell intermittently. I'd switched into my warmer blue waterproof jacket. Fierce winds knocked me around as I marched. The gusts were so strong that I had to lean into them to maintain my footing, making full use of my trekking poles to keep me upright. Even so, my progress was significantly slower. I spotted another grizzly on a mountain slope, but it seemed to pay me no attention. Then, as the route began to steeply ascend, I felt the burn in my legs. Crossing now from the Yukon into the Northwest Territories, the Dempster climbed through the windswept McDougall Pass, one of only 2 passes across the Richardson Mountains. This lonely pass over bleak and icy mountains was a scene of desolation. Scant vegetation grew amid the tumbled heaps of gray boulders and barren slopes, while large patches of snow remained in the shadows cast by the peaks. The wind howled violently as I trekked along. Somewhere to the north, I knew, the Richardson Mountains reached their apex, with the highest peaks exceeding 1,700 meters. The Yukon's mountain passes have seen their share of mysteries, murders, and adventurers, none more famous than the Mountie's doomed Lost Patrol. On December 21, 1910, a dog sled patrol consisting of 4 Mounties set off from the outpost of Fort McPherson to make the long, perilous journey south to Dawson. The weather was a balmy minus 29 Celsius, so the Mounties, under the lead of Inspector Francis Joseph Fitzgerald, were optimistic, carrying food for only 30 days. With Inspector Fitzgerald were Constables Richard Taylor and George Kinney and Special Constable Sam Carter, as well as 15 sled dogs divided between 3 sleds. To break a trail through the deep snows, the men took turns snowshoeing ahead on foot. The elements soon turned against the Mounties. Blizzards blinded them and temperatures plunged to a mind-numbing 50 below, the wind chill sometimes making it 70 below. The human body cannot long survive such extreme temperatures. The only thing to be done in such conditions is hunker down, take shelter, and stay warm. The Mounties, however, pushed on, battling frostbite and deep snows that slowed their progress. Given such conditions, they failed to find the frozen creek that pointed the way to Dawson. Unknown to them, they'd overshot the mark. When they realized their error, they couldn't locate the correct creek to follow, losing valuable time and food as they searched. On January 18th, with their food supply dwindling, they made the desperate decision to turn back to Fort McPherson, giving up any hope of reaching Dawson. That night, they butchered one of their own dogs for meat, but the other sled dogs refused to eat it. Without food, there was little hope, but desperation drove them on. The dogs, starving, now began to eat their own when offered it. One by one, they killed and ate their dogs, until by February, they had only 5 left. This kept them grimly going for a time, but frostbite and starvation closed in on them, and there was to be no escape from winter's icy grip. Taylor, Carter, and Fitzgerald perished from starvation and hypothermia, while Kinney, surrendering to despair, shot himself with a carbine. Fitzgerald was the last to die, having used a piece of charcoal to scribble out his will on a scrap of paper, leaving all the own to his mother in Halifax. His body was later found just 40 kilometers outside Fort McPherson by Sergeant Dempster, for whom the highway was subsequently named. I kept hiking. Below the windswept McDougal Pass were narrow canyons the road cut through, mountainous walls rising high on either side. There was barely any vegetation. Altogether, the impression was of a moonscape. Yet there was life in these desolate mountains. Dall's sheep, a type of hardy mountain sheep native to the northern Yukon, range among these precipitous peaks. The rams weigh several hundred pounds, with big, fantastically curved horns up to 3 feet long. They favor lonely crags and cliffs, bounding up seemingly impossible slopes with ease. When the opportunity presents itself, grizzlies and wolves are known to make meals of them, and even the great golden eagles that live in these mountains with their huge wingspans carry off the little lambs occasionally. I was hoping to spot a Dall's sheep bounding among the stony slopes, since in my mental checklist of animals I most wanted to see, they were in the top 3, along with a giant squid and a Sasquatch. As I came out of the barren, treeless Richardson Mountains, I found myself hiking past forests of dwarf tamarack and black spruce. Then, from a small prominence where the road rose up, I took in a vast panorama. To the north were imposing walls of snowy mountain ranges. To the south, endless wild land cloaked in stunted forests stretching to a far distant horizon, broken only here and there by placid blue lakes. To the east, I could see glimpses of the twisting course of the Peel River, and could just barely spot a scattered collection of white rooftops that made up the tiny hamlet of Fort McPherson, population 785. It had been founded as a fur trading post back in 1840. The town, however, wasn't on my route, as it lay just a little north of the main road I was following. Willow and alder bushes grew thickly along the roadside, reaching heights of 8 or 9 feet. Concealed in these thickets, I knew, were grizzlies. Their fresh tracks, sunk alarmingly deep into the gravel, littered the roadway. They might spring out at any time, but hopefully only to spook me for the fun of it. I kept marching, 1 foot in front of another. Slow and steady wins the race, I told myself. Another 10 kilometers or so and the road dropped into the lowlands of the Peel River. Here, conditions were less harsh than higher up. The trees were bigger, and now included white birch, though the birch were still far too small for canoe making. Foxtail barley, horsetails, yarrow, and fireweed all grew in abundance along the roadside. Along this stretch, my third day hiking, the weather became misty with intermittent rain. A big grizzly appeared, sauntering along the road in the most casual manner possible. It was a striking animal, with blonde tips on its thick, rich coat and impressive, curved claws. For a moment it looked as if it might charge me, but then the bear dipped back down into the willows, disappearing from view. Late on the third day I could see up ahead the waters of the Peel, about 200 meters wide. Nearby was a miscellaneous collection of shacks, trucks, and rubbish scattered about. Chuck and Mark were parked by the muddy bank, and Chuck had set up his tent there. Chuck and Mark had already made friends with the ferry operator and told him something of me and my plans. The ferry operator, Morris, a native of Fort McPherson and veteran boat captain familiar with the strong currents of the Mackenzie, expressed the opinion that upriver travel alone in a canoe was impossible. Only a motorboat with a strong engine could make it upriver, and even that was difficult and time-consuming. When Morris saw me arrive, somewhat wearied from my hike, he looked me up and down and asked, "What kind of drugs are you smoking?" "None," I assured him. "So you're just crazy, then." I thought I'd demonstrate my sanity by invoking a different subject. Morris, I noticed, sported an Edmonton Oilers hat. I alluded to the teams having made the playoffs for the first time in 11 seasons. Morris livened up. "Yes," he assured me, "the Oilers were back. They'd shown real promise." Morris, it turned out, had lived in Edmonton and was something of a fanatical Oilers fan. But now that Edmonton was eliminated, Morris explained, he wanted the playoffs' only remaining Canadian team, Ottawa, to win. He couldn't stand the thought of an American team claiming the cup again. The Senators were playing that night, so he had to be off soon so as not to miss the puck drop. Having noticed Chuck and Mark's lack of interest in our discussion, Morris asked me what the deal was with them. "Americans," I explained. The original plan was to have Chuck and Mark deposit my canoe and two barrels on the banks of the Mackenzie River, where I could pick them up. To do so, they'd have to take the car ferry across the Peel River, which the Dempster crosses. The ferry, though, was out of service for repairs. I'd planned for such a contingency by including among my expedition gear a small wheeled cart. That way, in the worst-case scenario with the river ferry closed on the Peel, thereby preventing Chuck and Mark from crossing in the vehicle, I could still transport my canoe and barrels to the Mackenzie River by wheeling them along the Dempster behind me. But this prospect was not at all appealing, as it'd be slow-going and time-consuming. Fortunately, Morris eliminated the need for the cart by offering to transport the canoe and barrels to the Mackenzie River. While the ferry was out of commission, he still had a motorboat at hand and a pickup truck on the opposite side of the Peel. I gratefully accepted this offer, and wondered if my favorable words about the Oilers had facilitated it. Chuck and Mark, meanwhile, had to take their leave. I owed them both a debt of gratitude. Besides helping transport my canoe and supplies to the river, Mark had given me his hiking boots. They were a size larger than my own, and my feet had swelled slightly from all the hiking, causing me considerable discomfort. He told me I could keep the boots, so I did. Chuck, too, had been overly generous. He'd given me his waterproof neoprene waders, lighter than the ones I'd packed. As they prepared to make the long drive back to Whitehorse, the two of them wished me well. Before they left, I rifled through my pack and discarded anything I didn't need, so as to travel even lighter and repay them in some way for their kindness. I had a pair of wool socks, worn, a pack of matches, half used, and two granola bars, unopened, that I could spare. I handed them over. The Mackenzie River had cleared of its winter ice just as I hoped it would by the last of May. On June 1st, 5 days after setting off from the Arctic Circle, I arrived on its muddy banks where the Dempster crosses it. As promised, Morris dropped off my canoe and two barrels, then wished me well on my fool's errand upriver. Nearby was the little community of Sigachik, population 195, where Morris had gone to visit his sister before returning to his post at the Peel River crossing. His was the last face I'd see for a while. Now, the real challenges would begin. Chapter 4. Up the Mackenzie. Up close, the swirling, rippling waters of the vast Mackenzie River did look alarmingly swift. At 1,738 kilometers long on its main branch, the Mackenzie is Canada's longest river and North America's second longest. It was understandable why pretty much everyone judged trying to canoe upriver on it an indication of insanity. It wasn't just that I was attempting to do it alone. It was also that I had over 170 pounds of dead weight to transport in the canoe. Two barrels crammed with food rations and a backpack holding my tent, camping gear, camera equipment, and miscellaneous other things, all of which would have to be propelled upriver against a powerful current still swollen with the recent ice melt. Even if I could maintain a paddling pace of 5 kilometers an hour, no mean feat with 170 pounds of dead weight against a 4 kilometer an hour current, That'd translate into only 1 kilometer an hour progress. At that rate, it would take me well over a month to get upriver to the point I needed to reach. Not at all feasible if I were to have any hope of success. So instead, I thought up a different plan. I hoped to rely on an ancient, though now largely forgotten, technique for upstream navigation: poling. Sticking close to the river's steep banks, I planned to delicately balance myself in a standing position while pushing a long pole off the river's bottom, advancing the canoe steadily upstream. It's an eloquent illustration of Newton's third law of motion. When one body exerts a force on a second body, the second body simultaneously exerts a force equal in magnitude and opposite in direction on the first body. My pushing down with the pole would meet with a second body, the river bottom, simultaneously exerting a force equal in magnitude and opposite in direction to my initial thrust with the pole, thus propelling the canoe upriver. A pole used in such a manner is far more effective than any paddle. But first I had to find myself a suitable pole. The Mackenzie here was about 1 kilometer wide, and across its icy, swirling waters, I could see a stand of trembling aspens. One of these hardy trees, I figured, would serve my purpose admirably. I shoved my canoe into the water, hopped in, and pushed off with my paddle in what was the first stroke of my journey across Canada's Arctic. To traverse it to reach the aspens, my canoe would have to be broadside to the current, meaning I'd have to paddle twice as hard. To compensate for the current pushing me back, I first headed some ways upstream, pointed my canoe farther yet upstream of where the aspens were, and then began paddling across, the current swirling around me, forming little whirlpools as I went. 15 minutes of hard paddling later, I'd landed on the opposite bank beneath the stand of aspens. A plump muskrat sat on the bank cheerfully chewing some willow shoots as I scrutinized the trees. About 10 feet long, I figured, would be enough to reach bottom if I stayed close to shore where the current was slacker. With my hatchet, I chopped down my chosen tree and then shaved off its branches, smoothing it down into a pole that could be easily wielded. The muskrat, meanwhile, finished his meal and plopped into the water with a splash, heading upstream in a steady dog paddle, or rather muskrat paddle, as if to show me the way. Steadying myself upright in the canoe, I began pushing against the river bottom with the pole, propelling myself along after the muskrat. Slow and steady wins the race, I told myself again. Another thrust, then another, each one flinging the canoe against the oncoming current, with me repeating the maneuver before the current could overcome the boat's forward momentum. The muskrat, for his part, now seemed to think better of the exercise. He took a gulp of air, sank beneath the swirling waves, and passed under the canoe, emerging a short way downriver, letting the current carry him back to the willows. Glancing over my shoulder, I saw him scramble up the muddy bank, give his coat a good shake, and then resume feasting on willows. I cast my eyes back upriver, in the direction I had to head. I couldn't see very far. Towering gray banks 100 feet high, like some kind of huge canal carved out by a giant long ago, curved around to the west, blocking the view. On top of these heights, I could make out lines of little trees, spruces, tamaracks, and a few places aspens. The skies were blue, with the sun beating down and glaring off the rippling waters. I kept on poling. I had to. Otherwise, I'd drift right back downriver. But it seemed to be working. At times, I'd bend my knees and pivot my body, giving the canoe an extra strong thrust. In a few places, though, large rocks beneath the water blocked my path. Here, I'd have to cautiously thrust out farther from shore, into the deeper water where the current was much stronger, then rapidly pull myself back in, skirting the rocks. I pulled my way into the enormous canyon known as the Lower Ramparts, which I'd seen from downriver. Pushing along, I soon fell into a rhythm. After the river rounded a sharp bend, the view opened up down a straighter stretch that extended for over 12 kilometers. It was a magnificent sight. No other great river in the world, not even the Amazon, is so free of human development and traffic as the Mackenzie still is. No buildings, radio towers, transmission lines, cottages, pipelines, or any other human-made objects appeared to litter the view. Just high gray cliffs crowned with rich, dark green forest, beyond which were rolling hills extending for hundreds of miles in either direction. Poling wasn't my only strategy for overcoming the river's powerful current. Some 6 hours into my upriver battle, I found the chance I'd been waiting for to implement another tactic. The wind had shifted. It was blowing from the northwest now, just what I needed to try out my second trick, a specially designed sail shaped like an umbrella that could be sprung open to catch the wind and just as quickly collapse when the wind shifted or died. If I could successfully harness the power of the wind, it'd be a nice help. But sailing a heavily laden canoe upriver on a wilderness expedition is easier said than done. Canoes aren't designed to be sailed. Not only are they light, shallow vessels without much means of rigging up a decent mast, but any such mast becomes a liability on portages, in rapids, or if you have to suddenly change direction, as happens a lot when going up a winding river. On an expedition, when time is critical and shifting quickly from one mode of travel to another is essential, a mast becomes a potentially dangerous thing to fiddle with. Which brings me to the secret of my sail's design. It didn't require a mast. It could simply be flown like a kind of kite, with one end secured firmly to the canoe's center thwart, and the other end tied with a string toward the back of the canoe. Just now the wind seemed favorable. So with a tinge of excitement and trepidation, I set aside my pole and gave a pull on the slipknots holding the little sail I'd reefed to the canoe's thwart. In an instant, the tightly coiled sail sprang out and caught the wind. I felt a sudden tug. It was pulling me upriver. I could hardly believe it. The canoe and I were shooting straight up the current. Hurriedly, I tied a shoelace from the sail to my canoe seat, securing it so that my hands might remain free. Then I snatched up my paddle and used it as a rudder to steer. In that moment, I felt what all sailors must feel when they first learn to harness the wind, an exhilaration that's half revelation, half jubilation at the wind carrying you along. With the sail up, I steered with my paddle and added strokes of my own to further improve my pace. It felt marvelous to sail a canoe upriver. Alas, this triumph lasted only 30 minutes before the wind shifted again. The sail abruptly fluttered and then fell flat over the canoe. It was back to poling. On the bright side, the sun was shining. The temperature was hovering around 9 degrees Celsius. And this early in the year, there were still no black flies and mosquitoes to torment all living mammals. Better yet, lots of birds were around to keep me company. Along the river's banks hopped little shorebirds, mainly sandpipers, which glide gracefully over the water. Also on the banks, chirping away, were robins, which during the summer are indeed found north of the Arctic Circle. They're one of the most widely traveled birds in North America, ranging from urban parks to northern tundra. As I was poling along, I also spotted a stately-looking bald eagle. Perched tall and proud on its spruce throne, high atop the banks, it seemed to survey the vast river lands that formed its domain with a touch of aristocratic disdain. Any fish, muskrat, baby beaver, Arctic ground squirrel, duckling, or other small bird that attracted its fancy might furnish it a meal. But most intriguing of all were the great sandhill cranes stalking along the mudflats. These giant birds, standing 3.5 feet tall and with a nearly 7-foot wingspan, are one of the eeriest birds in the north. Their sheer size, along with their thick gray plumage that almost looks like fur, and the bright red bands around their eyes, as if they're attending a costume ball, make them unmistakable. Their most peculiar characteristic, however, is their call. It's a kind of nervous, rattling sound. Something like a French horn mingled with a rusty gate opening and closing. The first time I ever saw one of these cranes was as a teenager. I'd been wandering in the wilderness with my best friend Wes for 3 weeks. One evening, while gathering firewood, I spotted a couple of these giant, spooky cranes near a clearing on the edge of a spruce bog. I had no idea what they were. To me, they looked like a ghostly mirage. Back at our campsite, I hesitated to even tell Wes I'd seen them. So bizarre did they appear, like a kind of Canadian emu. Maybe I'd been dreaming. In fact, sandhill cranes are not uncommon and can be found across much of North America's wild places, from the Gulf of Mexico, where they overwinter, all the way up to the Arctic coastline in summer. But in dark and gloomy subarctic forests, or on deserted tundra, there's something peculiarly striking about these distinctive birds with their red masks and eerie calls. Pulling up the Mackenzie that afternoon, I saw more sandhill cranes than I ever had before. A trio on a mudflat, a half dozen more wading along the shores, and another 9 or 10 soaring over the river. That night I made camp along the river's eastern bank on a patch of sand that promised to make for a comfortable night's sleep. The Mackenzie was nearly 3 kilometers wide at this point, although its current seemed just as strong, with eddies, ripples, and driftwood swirling by. I'd put in only 8.5 hours my first day, not having slept much the night before. Examining my maps, it seemed I'd made it about 20 kilometers upriver. This was fairly encouraging, and I was optimistic that in the days ahead, as I refined my methods and increased my hours, my daily distances would increase. Of course, much would depend on the wind. I gathered up some driftwood and fixed myself a nice cheering fire. With the driftwood crackling loudly, it wasn't long before my kettle boiled, giving me enough water to make tea and cook a freeze-dried meal. From my packed rations, I selected Forever Young Mac and Cheese from the brand Backpacker's Pantry. I found it particularly savory as I sat on a driftwood log and watched the great river rolling by, shorebirds soaring gracefully along it. Nearby on the mudflats were wolf tracks as well as some grizzly tracks. It was quite interesting to see how clearly their giant claws registered in the mud, unlike their much less vivid imprints on the Dempster. Some people think you should never camp in an area with signs of bears. Such people, I presume, wouldn't find camping along the Mackenzie River very agreeable. Signs of grizzlies are nearly everywhere in springtime. Survival books tend to advise all kinds of precautions when camping in bear territory, such as never bringing food anywhere near your camp, or even toothpaste. A few even go so far as to advise not sleeping in the same clothes you cook in, and some, if you can believe it, will tell you never to camp alone. I've always taken this kind of advice with a grain of salt. My packed food was the kind that doesn't give off much odor, a mix of dehydrated meals, rationed to one a day, and things that didn't need preparation, like high-calorie energy bars, granola bars, and protein bars supplemented by some jerky and dried fruits. Since these dried foods were all in sealed packages inside watertight plastic barrels, there didn't seem much likelihood of attracting bears. At night, I'd move the food barrels just a short distance away from my tent. Unlike in heavily visited parks farther south or near towns, the bears in remote wilderness areas are much wilder and much less accustomed to stealing camp food. On the other hand, wild bears are said to be more likely to attack humans. You can't have everything after all. Seeing how there was ample driftwood at hand, before turning in I did make a nice cheering fire on the beach. Most wild animals instinctively fear fire, and the scent of it is sometimes enough to keep bears away. Of course, out on the tundra there wouldn't be wood for a fire, and I'd likely sleep months without one. But that needn't concern me now. So I slept, peacefully, under the midnight sun, listening to the river murmur and the robins sing. The next day, June 2nd, I put in 9.5 hours of upriver travel, a combination of poling, some paddling for variety, and yet another technique meant to overcome the difficulties of upstream navigation. I experimented briefly with walking along the shoreline and dragging the canoe with a rope behind me. This method worked indifferently and wasn't as fast as poling proved. I also managed to do a bit more sailing when the wind was favorable. All in all, my progress that second day was better than my first. I made it 25 kilometers upriver. Partly what gave me the idea of experimenting with these different methods was reading a 228-year-old diary by Alexander Mackenzie, a hardscrabble adventurer and fur trader. In 1789, at the age of 25, he ventured down the river now bearing his name along with some dozen companions, mostly Canadian voyageurs, Dene hunters from lands to the south, and a stray German tossed in for good measure. After reaching the Arctic Ocean, Mackenzie and his companions retraced their route all the way back upriver, returning to their fur trade post on Lake Athabasca. Mackenzie's diary describes them as fighting their way upriver using various means, with some men hauling their large canoe with ropes along the shore, while others remained in the canoe, working to paddle and pole it together. Obviously, I couldn't replicate this combined approach on my own, but I did try out each method individually and found poling to be the most effective. I was hoping to keep improving my pace, but June 3rd saw a stiff headwind blow against me. Battling the current and the wind together was doubly difficult, yet I forced myself to keep poling regardless. 10 hours of hard effort saw me advance another 24 kilometers. This left my arms and back feeling pretty sore. There could be no thought of resting, though. The next day saw me again equal this distance, with more of the same headwinds that prevented me from raising sail. In the course of this fourth day struggling up the mighty Mackenzie, I felt my aspen pole crack after one hard push off the river bottom. This was a bit disconcerting, as scanning the banks I saw no signs of aspens from which to fashion a replacement pole. There were spruces and tamaracks aplenty, but to use a conifer would mean getting my hands coated in sticky resin. The conifers also have a lot of branches along their trunks, not ideal for fashioning a pole. Still, putting it into shore and searching for a suitable aspen would mean a costly delay. Then, suddenly, help arrived from an unexpected source. I could hardly believe my luck when I saw a perfectly sized stick, already cut and lying a short distance away on the bank. The teeth marks on either end of it showed plainly that it had been cut by a beaver. It seemed to be of balsam poplar, and likely had come from somewhere far upriver, drifting down with the current until it lodged where I found it. It was just the right length and thickness I needed. The water had already worn it smooth. After mentally thanking the beaver gods, I grasped the pole, leapt back into my canoe, and resumed poling with renewed vigor. That beaver-fashioned pole worked even better than my old one, and I was able to establish my best pace yet, making it 28 kilometers upriver that day. Over the following week, I continued my solitary journey upriver. Most of the time the wind was against me, including a three-day stretch in which I battled ceaseless headwinds that left me unable to use the sail at all. In places I found great mounds of ice still piled up on shore. In one spot where the river curved, the ice formed a continuous wall some 20 feet to 30 feet high, which was slowly melting in the June sun. I was somewhat apprehensive that, poling along these massive blocks of haphazardly stacked ice that formed caverns and caves, they might crumble and collapse onto me as I pulled by. The odd block of ice in the river showed clearly where some of the mounds had already collapsed, and the steady drip coming off the ice mounds in the noonday sun suggested that more might collapse at any time. If a block should topple over just as I passed it, I'd be crushed, or at least knocked clean into the river. Neither seemed appealing. This massive ice wall, forming towers and turrets, extended along the river's shore for about half a kilometer, looking in my imagination like some enchanted ice palace. Ideally, it'd be safer to stay outside the range of the ice mounds if they were to collapse, but this I couldn't do. It was too deep for my pole farther offshore. So in the spots where the ice seemed particularly precariously stacked and in danger of toppling over, I just pulled past as quickly as I could, passing by before the ice could fall. There's nothing like falling blocks of ice for maintaining a good traveling pace. Other places presented hazards of a different sort along the banks. One morning I came across a young blonde grizzly. The bear had its head down as it sauntered along the bank, apparently searching for food, and didn't notice me. When I saw the bear, I switched from my pole to my paddle, in order to stay a safe distance offshore. Here, the current wasn't too bad, so I paddled along for a bit. Eventually, the young grizzly noticed me, and after curiously looking at me for a few seconds, abruptly ran off into the woods. It seemed I'd terrified him. 3 days later, still poling along, I saw near a small stream a mother grizzly with two cubs. To my surprise, contrary to what you might expect a mother grizzly to do, she simply took one look at me and immediately turned around and ran off. Her two bewildered cubs, seemingly caught a bit off guard by their mother's sudden flight, looked wide-eyed at me a moment longer, then turned around and hurried after their mother. I got the strong impression that the cubs received a stern talking to that evening about how they'd been raised to know better than to linger staring at humans. In fact, as the days went by, it seemed to me that the grizzly's reputation for aggressiveness was somewhat exaggerated, as I found the grizzlies generally more timid than my experiences with both polar bears and black bears. In contrast to the grizzlies, landslides were a more serious concern along the Mackenzie's high banks. There were many dozens of areas where the banks had collapsed into enormous landslides that buried everything in their path. Some slides were over 100 meters wide, in the height of a three-story building, with full-grown spruces and aspens knocked over and now sticking out of the mud every which way like pins in a pincushion. As far as I could ascertain, the slides were triggered by some combination of stream-caused erosion, melting ice, rainfall, and the thawing out of the ground. At night, when selecting my campsites, I had to be extra cautious for any signs of impending landslides. To have an avalanche of mud and rocks slam into my tent and bury me while I was sleeping would really put a damper on things. Later, I learned that CBC News reported that the same summer I was poling along, a landslide on the Mackenzie River obliterated an entire log cabin, which was, fortunately, empty at the time. The landslides, because of the huge quantities of mud they wash into the river, caused other obstacles to upstream travel. When I tried to pole alongside one giant slide, I found that I could no longer push off the river bottom. The pole, rather than striking a hard bottom, simply kept sinking deeper and deeper into the soft, quicksand-like mud, failing to give any purchase for the thrust required to drive the canoe against the current. Nor could I get out and walk along the shoreline. I'd just sink into the mud if I tried. There seemed no other option but to try paddling. The current, however, was very strong, and the landslide of mud and tumbled spruces extended out into the river, forming a sort of weir that amplified the current's strength. Nevertheless, I began paddling, battling the current with each stroke. The mudslide stretched for about 150 meters, so if I could just manage to overcome the current for that long, I'd be able to resume poling. But as I edged away from shore to skirt around the slide, it felt like paddling on a treadmill. Then, as I began to tire, the current overwhelmed my efforts, and I drifted back to where I started. Until now, I'd been using a traditional paddle with a straight shaft, the familiar kind of paddle you see most everywhere. Mine had been crafted from ash for a strong shaft and spruce for an extra light blade. I loved my paddle, as only a canoeist can, but now it was time to try something different. Stored in my canoe, as yet unused, was a second paddle. It was shorter than my other one, with a wider, rectangular blade. But the real difference was the shaft. Its blade was set at an 8-degree angle. This odd-looking design, developed in the 1960s, is based on the principle that an angled blade will remain vertical in the water longer through each stroke than a traditional paddle. The result is increased power and efficiency. Bent shaft paddles are now the standard among competitive racing canoeists, although they're still uncommon among wilderness canoeists. I suspect that's partly because most canoeists are at heart romantics. Still, I thought it prudent to acquire one, and now I'd see if it could make the difference I needed. With the bent shaft paddle, I kneeled down in the canoe and threw all my effort into fighting the current. My strokes were quicker and shorter than before, each one pulling through the water with maximum efficiency. I edged around the fallen spruce, paddling furiously as I went. The bent shaft design was more awkward than my traditional paddle, and not as good for steering, but for sheer power, it had the advantage. My furious strokes propelled me upriver until I was safely past the landslide and able to resume poling. 5 days into my journey upriver on the Mackenzie, and I still hadn't seen another soul, an experience that would be hard to replicate on any other great river of comparable size, whether it's the Mississippi, Amazon, Nile, Congo, or Yangtze. But then, late in the evening of June 8th, I heard the distant sound of an engine coming from somewhere downriver. A small motorboat materialized with two men on board. They were gunning the engine hard, battling their way right up the middle of the river, about 0.5 kilometer offshore. When they spotted my tent, they steered in closer and hovered in the current. Over the roar of the engine and the distance between us, one of the men shouted, "Do you have any marijuana?" "No," I shouted back. This important inquiry out of the way, we discussed other matters, bellowing back and forth to be heard. They'd come from Inuvik, they told me, a small town about 300 kilometers downriver, and were on their way to Fort Good Hope, which lay another couple hundred kilometers upriver. It occurred to them the oddness of seeing me camped where I was on the bank so early in the season after the ice breakup. Normally, canoeists wouldn't arrive this far down the Mackenzie River until much later in the summer. They wanted to know, shouting to be heard over their boat's engine, how I'd managed to make it so far downriver this early in the year. I explain, shouting back, that I hadn't come downriver at all. I came upriver, I shouted. This revelation caused some bewilderment, and it was as much as I could do, shouting back and forth to explain things. When they realized that I'd indeed been traveling against the current, they now seemed to think I must be in some kind of trouble. They offered to help, explaining they had a satellite phone and could call for rescue if I was injured. I explained I was fine, but this only prompted an offer to take me in their motorboat to wherever it was I was going. Though, they said, my canoe would have to be left behind, as there wasn't space for it. When I insisted I was perfectly happy, they at last relented. Well, shouted the man at the engine, enjoy the Mackenzie, and if you ever make it to Fort Good Hope, come see us and we'll give you a place to stay and a good meal. With that, they waved goodbye and roared off upriver. The only other people I encountered along the Mackenzie during my 11-day journey up it were in two other motorboats. The first was another small boat, also battling the current upriver, this time carrying three men in a snowmobile. They were too far away to communicate with, as where I spotted them, the Mackenzie was over 3 kilometers wide. The other boat I saw was a much larger one, also in the distance. Scanning through the zoom on my camera, I made out that it was the Coast Guard ship Ekalu. On its three-tiered deck were two smaller boats covered in tarps and a crew swarming about. To me and my little red canoe, the giant, noisy Coast Guard ship powering up the river with its mighty diesel engines was an odd sight. As far as I could tell, the Ekalu was steaming along the river in order to lay out navigational buoys, to open it up for boat traffic now that the ice had cleared. Without buoys, the Mackenzie's shifting sandbars and mudflats pose a hazard for boats. Meanwhile, my pace continued to improve. On June 6, I'd made it another 32 kilometers upriver, mostly by poling aid it with a little sailing, and I managed to replicate this success over each of the next few days. As I became more adept at sailing, I experimented with trying to sail and pole together. This unorthodox method turned out to be quite effective when the wind wasn't too strong. I tottered a few times when gusts hit the sail, but with my beaver-made pole I was always able to stay upright and keep pushing along. The result was better progress upriver than even I dared to hope possible, a full 37 kilometers in a single day, which I managed twice. That was accomplished in just 10 hours, with 3 hours of combined sailing and poling, in 7 hours of only poling. My progress might have been better yet had it not been for a costly delay. I'd come upon a long, flat, muddy island, and rather than pole the long way around by sticking with the river's main channel, I decided, not without some hesitation, to remain close to the eastern bank I'd been following. There was a chance the mud island might be only a dead-end bay. My maps indicated that it was an island, but maps aren't always to be trusted. Shifting channels and fluctuating water levels can make islands disappear and reappear. However, I reasoned that since it was still only the first week of June, given the recent ice melt, high water levels ought to indicate a clear passage. Moreover, the current on the near side of the island wasn't as strong, and this enticed me to chance following it to avoid the main current on the far side. But the farther I went, the thicker the weeds and the shallower the water became until, after 20 minutes of poling, the channel abruptly terminated in a mudflat. It wasn't a channel after all, but merely a long, narrow bay. I'd have to take off my hiking boots and wool socks, roll up my pants, and haul my canoe and gear across the mudflats that separated me from open water. But there was no way to haul over 200 pounds across the quicksand-like mudflats, which I sank into as soon as I stepped out of the canoe. Instead, I had to carry each load across individually, sinking past my ankles into the cold mud with each step. A trio of curious sandhill cranes silently watched as I struggled across with the different loads. The effort of hauling my gear across mudflats caused me to work up a thirst. Attached to my backpack was a small handheld water filter. It was brand new for this journey, and I'd upgrade it to a better model than the type I normally relied on. After all, you don't want to skimp on water safety. and it was certainly a comfort to have a top-of-the-line model at hand now, especially since the waters of the Mackenzie are exceptionally muddy and silty. I dipped the intake hose into the river and the output hose into my water bottle. Then I began pumping, marveling at the efficiency of the contraption. Abruptly, the filter clogged. Then water burst out of the seams. I could hardly believe it. Inspecting the device, it had ruptured and broken irreparably, apparently a result of how dirty the river was. The irony of this I found amusing. The thought of drinking untreated water for months to come has rather less so. Still, there was nothing for it. I could boil my water at night, but not during the day, when by necessity I'd be unable to stop. Even my breakfasts and lunches were just energy bars that could be eaten on the fly. I took heart in the fact that I'd recently read the results of a new science study that had concluded, somewhat unexpectedly, that most water in backcountry rivers, lakes, and streams was generally safe to drink. On the other hand, I'd also read reports that contradicted this, though I preferred not to think too much of those ones at the time. At any rate, I was now offering myself up as a guinea pig to see what would happen from months of drinking untreated water across the Canadian North. If I were to get sick with giardia, a type of microscopic parasite found, among other places, in wild animal feces, my journey would end rather badly from a personal perspective, though perhaps well for medical science. At the moment, though, my concern was in finding somewhere to make camp. Considerable stretches of the river were lacking in camping places, due to canyon walls, steep banks, mudslides, heaps of driftwood, and piles of melting ice. When traveling downriver, it can be easy to take for granted finding a suitable site to camp, as if nothing looks promising. One can always drift along with the current until something better shows up. Not so, though, when dealing with upriver travel, when at the end of a long, wearisome day of battling the current, one has to take whatever one can get. June 10th was such a day for me. For a long while, I'd been passing high, muddy banks that came right down near the water's edge, not leaving space enough to pitch my tent amid the driftwood. So when I finally happened upon a clear spot that looked level enough to camp, set back some way from the river edge on a partially sloping bank, I took it. However, upon closer inspection, the spot wasn't as level as it appeared from the water, and there were wild rose bushes with thorns that weren't very comfortable for sleeping on. But scanning ahead upriver, I couldn't see any more promising sight, and there were huge quantities of spruce logs currently drifting downriver, which, presenting the obstacles that they did, made me indifferent to the idea of pushing on. So far, the Mackenzie had kindly given me charming campsites on soft sand beaches, spoiling me with their ease of access. Now it looked like I'd have to haul my gear and climb the high bluffs to find a site in the woods above. If it'd been only a matter of sleeping on a slope and some thorns, I might have tolerated it for one night, but I'd also noted the banks here looked partially susceptible to a landslide. Such slides were very common, as I'd passed many during the day. I carefully inspected the soil. It seemed fairly hard-packed and dry, and there hadn't been any rain lately. But still, for peace of mind, I decided not to chance it. So, after securing my canoe and barrels on shore, I took my backpack and climbed up the high, steep banks to the forest above. It was thickly grown with dead black spruces, their ghostly, claw-like branches reaching out every which way, as well as aspen, poplar, and even a few dwarf birches. Amid them, I spotted a patch of sphagnum moss that was just big enough for my tent. After dining on freeze-dried shepherd's pie, I crawled into the tent, rolled up my second pair of clothes for a pillow, and stretched out in my sleeping bag. It was a cooler night, 3 or 4 degrees above freezing. Strangely, as I'd been setting up my tent beneath the dead spruces, something I'd done hundreds of times before, a vague sense of unease had come over me. There hadn't been any sign of grizzlies about, as far as I could tell, and so I tried to dispel the feeling by talking out loud. Yet, as I drifted off to sleep, at some suppressed, almost unconscious level, that odd premonition remained. Chapter 5. Eastward Bound. Around 2:30 a.m., I woke to the sound of snapping branches. Something was out there, moving through the spruces. Rather than remain silent and still, as instinct might suggest, I yelled, "Hey, hey, hey," in a deep voice. As I did, I sprang from my sleeping bag, grabbed my knife and bear spray, and unzipped the tent's door on the side nearest the noise. In the eerie twilight gloom of the Arctic summer night, I saw through the dead spruces something moving, a huge grizzly 30 feet off. Then, as my eyes focused, I realized it wasn't a grizzly, but something else entirely. A massive, prehistoric-looking creature, an Arctic musk ox with huge curved horns. The great musk ox, weighing half a ton, glared at me. "My goodness," I thought, "I'd almost rather it was a grizzly." I dropped my bear spray and instead grabbed my bear banger. Hurriedly, with the musk ox staring at me, I fired a banger into the air. It launched up like a firework, exploding with a bang above the trees. The musk ox, startled by the bang, paused for a moment, still looking at me, then galloped off, smashing and crashing through the fallen spruces as if they were mere matchsticks. I waited until I could no longer hear the musk ox anymore. Then I waited some more, casting glances every which way, trying to see through the ghostly gray spruces. Finally, when I convinced myself it was safe to do so, I climbed back into the tent and my sleeping bag. I'd met with musk ox before, strange and eerie-looking beasts, a sort of Arctic bison, but only in the far north of the high Arctic. Up there on the windswept, desolate snows of the Arctic islands, owing to the harsh conditions, the musk ox were smaller. I'd found them to be mostly gentle giants that left me alone as I camped and paddled along. But here along the Mackenzie, the more hospitable climate allowed the musk ox to grow much larger. The big bull that had stirred me from my sleep was the largest I'd ever seen. After a few more hours of uneasy sleep, I was on my way. Leaving that spot among the bluffs, it was one campsite I'd be happy not to see again. Later that morning, as I pulled along, I spotted another musk ox, half hidden in some poplars. Then, a few kilometers on, deposited on the mud bank, was a musk ox skull. My curiosity was such that I couldn't help but to stop to look at it. The enormous thing, horns and all, I estimate it weighed 50 pounds. At the front of their skulls is a mass of hard bone, forming a kind of protective shield. The shield helps protect the males when they gallop and charge into each other, smashing their heads together with thunderous force. Such fierce contests are used to determine mating, sometimes inflicting severe and even fatal injuries on the losing musk ox. By midday on June 12th, I'd reached the end point of my journey along the Mackenzie, a smaller tributary flowing in from the east known as the Hare Indian River. This little-known waterway would, I hoped, lead me eastward for several hundred kilometers, almost to the vast, icy waters of Great Bear Lake itself. It wasn't, however, the obvious route into Great Bear from the Mackenzie. Looking at a map or satellite image, you'd almost immediately see that the obvious choice for getting from the Mackenzie River to Great Bear Lake is a larger river farther south. That's the Bear River. It connects directly to the lake and has in fact been used for centuries as a traditional travel route. In contrast, the river I planned to follow, the Hare Indian, doesn't reach all the way to the lake, but instead terminates in a dead end, which bars the way forward with miles of mosquito-infested swamps, tangled willows, and boulder fields. Why then, assuming I wasn't crazy, would I go that way? Simple. In keeping with the spirit and intention of my journey, I wanted to stay as far north as I could, whereas the Bear River lies a further 200 kilometers south. Besides, my curiosity naturally inclined me to the lesser-known route, despite the difficulties. I was happy to bid goodbye to the Mackenzie not only because I was eager to push on with my journey, but also because I didn't relish drinking silty, untreated water along it. I'd filled my water bottle from clear feeder streams whenever I chanced to camp near one. Given all the sediment that washes in along its great banks, the Mackenzie is a naturally muddy, silty river. But where it meets the clear waters of the Hare Indian River, an odd effect is produced. It looks something like water and vegetable oil being poured into a bowl together. An abrupt division between the two rivers' waters is plainly visible, similar but on a smaller scale to the famous meeting of the waters in Brazil, where the coffee-colored Amazon joins the dark waters of the Rio Negro. My progress up the Mackenzie had been better than expected, but I knew that could easily change if wind, ice, or any number of other factors turned against me. Still, before setting off up the Hare Indian, I planned to make a detour south on foot to Fort Good Hope, population about 500, where the two men I'd met in the motorboat had gone. It was the last inhabited place I'd see until reaching Baker Lake, Nunavut, still thousands of kilometers away, across the immense wilderness forming the heart of northern North America. So the extra 10-kilometer hike seemed worth it, as I could pick up a few essentials, fresh batteries, boxers, and perhaps some yogurt, maybe even blueberry yogurt, should they have such a delicacy. I paddled across the mouth of the Hare Indian River. It was too deep for poling, to its southern bank, where it joined the Mackenzie. A couple of small motorboats lay pulled up on shore. Behind them, a gravel path led into the woods. I secured my canoe and then set off on foot for town. Founded as a fur trade post back in 1805, Fort Good Hope was the scene of a famous clash in the 1970s over the proposed Mackenzie Valley pipeline. A consortium of oil companies sought to build what would have been the world's largest natural gas pipeline, running right through the valley. The local Dene communities, like Fort Good Hope, argued passionately against it on the grounds that it would destroy their traditional way of life by disrupting wildlife habitats, especially caribou. Facing tremendous local opposition, the federal government shelved the project. But times change, and a generation later, with the influence of the old traditionalists fading, the local Dene and Inuit groups now joined a consortium led by Imperial Oil, with a promise to receive 1/3 of the profits from the Mammoth Pipeline. The approval process dragged on until, in 2010, the government finally gave the go-ahead. Construction was set to begin in the near future. Thus, as I pulled my way up the mighty Mackenzie, I assumed, with an undeniably sad air, that I was bearing witness to the final days of the North's greatest river in its natural state. But, in December 2017, Imperial Oil opted out, bowing to changing economic realities that had opened up more promising reserves elsewhere. Still, most observers were optimistic, if that's the word, that the world's insatiable demand for fossil fuels will eventually revive the pipeline. Despite its geographic remoteness, I found Fort Good Hope to be a thoroughly modern town. Shiny new pickup trucks, brought in by ice roads, rumbled through the streets, while in a sign of the times, people seemed to move about with eyes glued to their phones. A giant transmission tower had been erected overlooking town to provide reception. As I made my way down the main street, half a dozen planes suddenly roared across the skies, performing aerobatic maneuvers. They were there, I learned, as part of a touring Arctic air show that had been conceived as a Canada 150 project. Inside the store, I quickly picked up what I needed. Everyone I met was friendly, asking if I'd come for the air show. I explained about the yogurt and the boxers. As I was leaving town, I happened to spot one of the men from the motorboat I'd met days earlier along the Mackenzie. "You made it?" he said, apparently shocked. "Yes," I said. Now that there were no revving boat engines, conversation came easier. "You know," he said, "it's a lot easier to travel the Mackenzie the other direction." "I've heard that." "You're the first guy I've ever heard of to canoe upriver. Are you nuts?" I just laughed and shrugged. I wasn't actually the first, but the fact that he thought so reinforced the oddness of it. He again offered me a place to stay, but I had to be on my way. It was all I could do, pressed for time as I was and a little shy after weeks alone, to decline offers of a hot shower or a lift to the airport to see the assortment of planes up close. So we parted, he for the airport and me for the river. My detour to Fort Good Hope had taken less than 3 hours. There was still plenty of light, but rather than face the uncertain prospect of paddling up a new river, where decent camping places might be difficult to find, I decided to make camp where I'd left my canoe. I'd get an early start in the morning. It had been a cold, windy day with some light snow that later gave way to rain, followed overnight by more snow. Inside my little tent on the riverbank, I was warm and snug, despite my sleeping bag having lost much of its warmth through regular use. But I wasn't troubled, as whenever it was cold, I always slept fully dressed. Normally, I didn't even bother taking my jacket off. The great thing about this method, I find, is not only does it keep you warm, but you also lose no time getting dressed in the morning. You can just spring up and go. Occupying my thoughts that snowy night was what might await me on the Hare Indian River. The people I'd spoken to in town weren't able to say much about the river beyond its first shallow rapids, as it wasn't possible for motorboats to get beyond that, and their focus was naturally on the vast Mackenzie. However, in winter there was a seasonal ice road that at one junction crossed the river, so trucks and snowmobiles